Pharaoh Jordan River and put his foot on the whole, on the soil of the Holy Land. That's all that he wanted. And the angel of death ridiculed his dream, his great vision, and blocked the way. This is fate. Moses somehow couldn't triumph over the angel of death. This is fate. Then Moses' life, the last minute, Moses' life was not a free creative act. It was a factum. He accepted, bowed his head before this unalterable fate, and died a lonely person. You ask me, where is destiny? Destiny is reflected in Moses' victory over the rock. When Moses took his cane and hit with the cane over the rock, and the rock yielded water, this symbolizes the great triumph of the spirit over matter, of men over insensateness, nonsense, and absurdity in nature, of men infusing some logic in his environment, or some semblance of coherence and orderliness in a crazy, friendly, unfriendly environment. Moses dying on the Mount Nebo, glancing at the shores of that land of Canaan, not being able to cross the Jordan River, is the manifestation of fate. Jacob struggling, again, another one, Jacob struggling with the divine antagonist. Martin Buber said that this chapter dealing with the struggle is perhaps the highlight of the Jewish experience. I'm inclined to agree with him in some respect. If you'll just open the Bible, and you'll take, just a moment, yes, the Bible, and you'll just take 33, verse 25. Genesis 33, verse 25. Genesis 33, verse 25. Here is dramatized the struggle between men and fate, and triumph of men over fate. Vayivoser Yaakov levado, and Jacob was left alone. But not a lonely person. The lonely person is defeated. The person who is alone sometimes is triumphant. And there wrestled a man with him, very mysterious man, until the breaking of the day. And when he saw, it means the man saw, that he prevailed not, he cannot prevail over Jacob, against him, cannot prevail not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. And then 27, and he said, the man said, let me go. Jacob was so triumphant that he simply kept the man, held the man in his grip. And the man not only didn't defeat Jacob, but couldn't free himself. When dawn and the day, when this daybreak, he wanted to leave, so to say, Jacob, he couldn't free himself. Let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, Jacob said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. You must concede defeat. And he said unto him, what is thy name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with man, and hast prevailed. This is exactly men wrestling with his destiny, and somehow emerging from this struggle, triumphant, of course, not in terms of absolute victory. Jacob also then had his defeat with Joseph. But he is triumphant sometimes. Jacob bowing, and you want to ask me again, where did Jacob reflect an event? Reflect again fate in Jacob's life? Because Judaism does not consider that a human being can completely convert his fate into destiny. Of course, at certain moments, he rises to great heights and he forges his own destiny. At certain moments, he's so helpless and weak that he just bows to fate. Jacob himself struggled with the antagonist. It was a divine antagonist, somehow mysterious antagonist, and displayed so much heroism, so much fortitude and courage. Jacob himself, in the same chapter, chapter 33, verse 3, and he passed over before them when he met his brother Esau, and bowed himself to the ground 7 times, until he came near to his brother. Where's the courage in Jacob? Why did he bow to Esau? Why didn't he engage Esau in a struggle and defeat Esau as he defeated the divine antagonist? This is the tragedy of man. Man fluctuates between fate and destiny. But of course, I mean, at certain moments, even the greatest among us bows to fate. Has no consciousness, has no courage, simply to forge his own destiny and to become the master over his environment. Yes, sir. I mean, there's Dr. Eisenberg asked me before. You wanted to ask me something.
I wanted to ask you whether, in the light of what you said before, Judaism rejected Essenism as a way of life.
I'll tell you, as a matter of fact, it's hard to say. We know so little about the Essenes that it's hard to judge them. I don't believe that the Essenes were cultivating what do you call odium mundi, hatred of the world. It's more was in the sense of an order, of course. They developed practices I wouldn't say self-torture, but at least of self-discipline. But to say that the Essenes are like the fathers of the desert or the medieval monks would be unjust to them. As to our attitude, the Talmud does not mention them, you know, very well. Uh-huh. And the fact the Talmud ignore them means there isn't complete approval of their practices. Yes. This was one of the
How about Trappistic monasticism?
I beg your pardon?
The monasticism of the Trappists.
Of course, I mean, we reject all kinds of monasticism. Because monasticism means complete disengagement. It's all a question of degrees. But, of course, I mean, monasticism it preaches disengagement from society. Prophetic solitude never preached disengagement from society. Complete engagement in social activities, giving of oneself as much as possible, but from time to time, retreat on the part of the individual into himself. Monasticism means complete retreat. I mean, there isn't the dialectical movement. I always speak of dialectical movement like a pendulum, which swings back and forth. This should be actually, this is the philosophy of Judaism with regard to man. Monasticism is not a pendulum swing back and forth. I mean, all forms of monasticism, the milder forms and the more extreme forms, preach just movement in one direction, away from. Judaism says away from and back to.
Celibates?
It's hard to see. It looks like that. It's hard to say. We know that it'll perhaps these documents which were discovered lately, the scrolls, perhaps will shed more light upon their sins. Yes, sir. What did you want to ask, Mr. Zekerman?
Faith and destiny. Is one a question of defeat and the other one a question of victory at all?
I said not. One is defeat, complete defeat, and one is victory whenever possible.
But
there's no promise of victory, I want you to say.
But
there's no promise.
Victory always connected with the supernatural?
No. Did I mention it?
Well, you didn't say it that way.
No, so why should you suspect me of...
Well, I have a right to imply
something. Okay, I'm just there, sir. All I said, of course, if you call the help of God supernatural, certainly. But God can intervene, you see, in a very natural way, through the cosmos.
But is it possible for man to determine his own destiny or to help himself?
To some extent.
Without the aid of God?
No, I wouldn't say that. No. I'll come as far... I know your point. I'll come later to your point. The question of the secular Jew. For the time being, I speak of a Jew. He's a Jew not for himself, but before his creator. This is...
This
gentleman asked.
Ray, when you first started to speak, you talked about that man was bound to be defeated in life.
Finally. In death. In death, man, when he dies, is not a man of destiny, but a man of fate. Every man. Moses, Jacob, Abraham, there is no man on his deathbed who forges his destiny. but man who succumbs to fate, to cruel, insensate, crazy, I mean, simply fate. All right, yes, sir?
Well, I'm trying to translate this psychologically in terms of what it does to any man.
You mean in practical terms? As to consequences, in my opinion, yes, please.
Well, and also whether or not there is sufficient difference between the Jewish as against the Christian attitude, where man is doomed almost from the beginning.
Yes, there is only one difference.
This is fundamental.
Yeah, I understand very well. In Christianity, men cannot act. Men, all men can do is wait for God to intervene and receive his grace. Nothing else. Men cannot change himself. Men cannot triumph over circumstances. It's only the grace of God. I'll come to it later. Judaism insists upon freedom of will. Whether scientists of today agree with that or not, it's a basic tenet of Judaism. Freedom. Man is free to act. God may be helpful, but God never takes the initiative. Man has to take the initiative. God perhaps clinches, completes the job, consummates his endeavor, but initiative must be taken by man. Christianity, on the contrary, the initiative is God's. Perhaps man can participate later, but the beginning belongs to God. This is the basic difference. That's why Christianity, Judaism preached activism. For instance, the question of disease. Christianity couldn't cope with disease. Christian science, until now, cannot understand the problem of healing a person who is inflicted by a disease. Yes, if God inflicted evil, some man should suffer. I mean, that Catholics have hospitals now, trained doctors, is just a concession to the so-called seculum, to the interim period. Nothing else. A concession. Nothing else but a concession. Nothing else. Judaism and the Bible, thousands of years ago, still people thought of sickness in terms of spirits and ghosts. So the Bible said, "Therapy, therapy," and the doctor should heal. The physician should heal. Activism. Combat. Active combat of evil. I'll come yet to the problem of evil. I mean, it does not interfere with Jewish activism. But there is only one thing. Activism does not imply an assurance, ipso facto, an assurance of success. And that's exactly what I think is wrong with modern man. He won when he is active, when he gives his best, so to say, to a project, to an ideal, he wants to be assured of success. And if success, I mean, does not come his way, many times it happens so, in our individual lives, in our national, with regard to our national problems, so man is completely shattered. Let's continue for a while. Yes, sir.
We talk about this world not being the world of interim. But what about the discussion in the Talmud about whether it is better that man be created or not be created?
Just a different problem. I'll tell you frankly. I'm still in doubt about it. This problem has not been resolved for me yet. Whether man should have been created or not. What does the Talmud say?
But now that he's created.
It would have been better if man hadn't been created at all. But since he is created, he was created, let him act. That's what Talmud says. He fashpish b'maaso, let him act. Metaphysically, perhaps, the best solution, the best exit, I mean, of all our, so to say, paradoxical situations would be nihility. Of course, complete non-existence of man. But since man exists, the Talmud said, Yifash Pesh B'Masav, let him act. Let him understand himself and act. Let me continue. Each one, gentlemen, can convert fate into destiny if he infuses into a seemingly stupid situation some sense and purposefulness. When directedness is added to fate, fate is not directed, does not aim at anything. When directedness and purposiveness is added to fate, destiny is born. And loneliness turns into aloneness, or prophetic solitude. Then the frustrating element is eliminated, anxiety can be conquered, and the disjunctive emotion of worthlessness may be converted into an elevating feeling What is needed is the courageous act of recentering the personality and shifting emphasis from the without to the within. At the first stage of loneliness anxiety, the afflicted person goes out of himself into the surrounding world. His self-appraisal revolves not around the unique inner self, the unfathomable individuality in all its charismatic singularity, but about a pale reflection against the backdrop of externalization. His self-esteem is measured by conventional outside standards of accomplishment and conquest. Majesty is the keynote of self-evaluation for modern men. Don't appear majestic. Majestic usually is equated with power. Powerful doesn't mean only political power in the sense of Hitler or Stalin or Khrushchev. What I mean more, it should make an imprint upon society. His footsteps should not be lost, completely erased when he disappears from the stage. To have a hold of a society, somehow. This is majesty. It's a very worthy objective. Yes, majesty is the keynote of self-valuation. And majesty is measured by success. And success is the determining factor. And in the second phase, when man is within himself, for himself, when it's not fate anymore, he's not fate, he doesn't represent fate but destiny, majesty takes a secondary place to a much higher objective, dignity. There's a difference. Dignity, not majesty. Before you become majestic, you should be a dignified being. And dignity cannot be realized if man looks into a mirror constantly and wants to see his reflection. And of course, the mirror is the Tao. He's not a dignified. First, on the contrary, he lacks dignity. He's copying, he's plagiarizing, he's imitating. Dignity goes hand in hand with originality, creativity, being himself, being what he is, not what others think of him. I'll still come back when I'll speak about the Jewish observance, about the problem of dignity and majesty. It's a very important problem, because David called man the covert v'hador teatreu. It means you surround him with majesty and dignity. I'll show you what it is, where it is in the Psalms. I exactly don't remember the chapter, the number of the chapter, but it's somewhere in the beginning. No. It is Keresh Amecho Maseh Besecho, Yoriach Vekhovim. Here I have it. I believe, just a moment. Yeah. It is Psalm 8. Yeah. Wait, Psalm. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, not the angels, than God, actually. And thou crownest him with glory and honor. It's a wrong interpretation, a translation. Covered in Hebrew means majesty. Baruch Shom Shem Kvod Malchuse means His Majesty. Kvod Malchuse, what means Kvod Malchuse? His Royal Majesty. Kavod means majesty, and Hador does not mean beauty, but dignity. So David actually has defined man as a being who can be both majestic and dignified. It's all a question of order, of priority. What comes first? Majesty or dignity. Man can attain both, but it depends how he starts out on his way. What's the point of departure? The point of departure is not majesty, it's dignity. And dignity is not outside of man, but within him.
Mr. Rabbi, tax appropriation is an act of destiny.
You mean natural appropriation?
Yes.
It's so both. It's fate and destiny. A man can actually act as a father both according to the dictates of fate, and he can also, I mean, this his fatherhood convert into an aspect of destiny. Both. Man procreation is animal. It's an animal function. On the other hand, fatherhood is a concept, the human, a concept already, I mean, which is closely knitted to his humanity. Of course, man can act as a father both at the level of faith and level of destiny. I'll come to it, really. Prophetic solitude, I want to say, is not the share of the few. It is not an esoteric endowment. It belongs to men in general, because his charismatic election manifests itself mainly in dignified appearance rather than in majestic triumphs or in majestic winning. Even the old, the sick, the crippled, the simpleton, the anonymous person, the lonely person may elevate himself from the awareness of loneliness to that of being alone. The abandoned, the deserted, the isolated person is lost. The inmate of an institution is lost, is a number. The prisoner in a cell is lost, is a number. But the outside world is nothing. There is no charisma which he can pass, which he is able to pass on. There is no message which society, I mean, desires to hear or to accept. But if it's a question of no majesty to the prisoner, no majesty to the inmate of a home for old, I mean, for the old, there is no majesty to the sick person in a hospital for incurable diseases. But there can be dignity. But dignity is within. All he has to do to withdraw, he has got to accept a little bit of defeat. Defeat by society. And withdraw from the craving for majestic living. From the outside, from his craving for outside recognition and turning his glance toward a worthy, dignified existence. Now, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, let us speak about the Jew a while. For the Jew of today, just a moment, yes. And basically, it means when I speak about dignity, is man should exile himself for a while, I mean mentally, inwardly, from society and its standards. But this exile results later in return, basically. If man is proud of himself and he can exile himself from society, it results later in return. You know, in the Bible, it's always there is no exile without return, exile. Political, always exile, return. Man himself can go through this experience of exiling himself. I lost the society. You know, as a rabbi, you know, I deliver a speech. The speech is not accepted by the crowd. I am in despair. I'm old, so I don't care too much about it. But a young rabbi, when I meet one of my students, so I mean, of course, usually I come into New York on Tuesday or Wednesday, and I see your speech was bad on Saturday morning. All you have to do is take a look at his face. And then I read a speech, sometimes the speech was bad, maybe. And then sometimes it was a wonderful speech, but the people there in the congregation were stupid, they couldn't understand. So, but the rabbi, it doesn't matter. He never asked himself a simple question. Did I fail because I didn't prepare a good speech? Then it means it's a lack of dignity. It was not creative. Actually, his dignity is affected. Or did I fail because the speech was too good? It was above. Then it's not my fault. There's no majesty, of course, involved. Majesty means when the orator establishes contact with the crowd, with the audience, of course. But dignity should not be affected. And as long as one's dignity is not affected, the personality can have a wholesome experience of self-worth and self, so to say, self-centeredness. Now let us tackle this problem as the Jewish loneliness. In this transition from loneliness to prophetic solitude, to unique existence, may lie the answer to our perennial problem of our loneliness as Jews, as a community, and also as individuals. We experience it quite often. Which has not disappeared with the birth of the Jewish state. On the contrary, the loneliness of the Jew was emphasized with the emergence of the Jewish state, of the state of Israel, has become more pronounced and more frightening. This was one of the mistakes of Herzl and political Zionism. They thought, we are lonely because there are people in exile. But the moment we'll establish a state, we'll send delegates to the United Nations, to any international assembly, and we'll have our ambassadors, and we'll exchange diplomatic notes, so we'll be equals. This is the basic philosophy of Herzl in the Medinat HaYehudim, in the state of the Jews. This is the basic philosophy. This is, so to say, the undertone, so to say, of Medinat HaYehudim. Of course, I don't have to preach too much about it. Not only did the individual Jew not gain a normal status in society, but even the Medinat HaYehudim as a state is the loneliest state on earth. The loneliest state. I can tell you, of course, it was the representatives of the Jewish state, the United Nations, how they feel. So one of the leading representatives, I don't want to mention him, told me, people think that there is glory in it. How foolish they are. It is such an excruciating experience to be a representative of the Jewish state. I am the loneliest creature on earth in the United Nations. And I said, when I felt lonely, when America, the American representative, and the British representative, and the French representatives, France is supposed to be a good friend of Israel, the French representative, support my viewpoint, and they speak, in favor of Israel. I feel how isolated I am. In the lobby, I feel that the representative of NASA has friends, he is a part of society. I'm outside. I'm just quoting verbatim. I didn't experience it. It was quite an experience. It's a fact. One of the leading representatives. I don't want to mention them. What is it? I want to understand. It may become a neurosis with Jews. Absolutely. Many times, it assumes forms of a neurosis. The Jew is so afraid of being isolated that he visualizes, that he pictures ghosts himself. It is just a figment of his imagination, yes. But somehow I would like to discuss this problem, to analyze it a bit deeper, not to just leave it, to say, to dismiss it, just with the movement of our hand and say, it doesn't exist. There's a problem, I know it, and you know it, everybody knows it. I would say that a Jew is lonely because he's too much bent on majesty. He wants to be too majestic, too impressive. If the Jew would cultivate dignity instead of majesty, many of his problems would be solved. We are too charismatic. It means we want to pass on a message, and we want society, general society, to appreciate our message, to praise us, to give at least lip service to us, lip service, compliments. We are like a prima donna, who likes always to be in the limelight and always to hear the critics, praise our performances. We have a complex. We suffer from a prima donna complex, a nervous, capricious prima donna in many times. And of course, a nervous, capricious prima donna, what's the name of the one whose contract has been canceled by so many opera companies, is, I would say, does not display a sense of dignity. Perhaps majesty, I don't know. Dignity, certainly not. We are like the prima donna. I believe when the Jew would recenter himself, recenter his personality as an individual and as a community, around the aspect of dignity, many of his problems, I wouldn't say all his problems, but many, would be solved. Then the whole community will be called upon to experience, of course, also a crisis, but not a disjunctive, so to say, in a disjunctive manner, but something which is creative. For the Jew of today, the problem can be formulated as follows. And I'll be very, so to say, very ruthless in formulating this problem. There's no use of hiding the problem. Shall Jewishness remain a fate, or shall Jewishness become a destiny for the Jew? Very simple. In terms of our previous definition of fate and destiny, shall the Jew act like Moses on the Mount of Nebo, feeling weak and helpless, not being able to triumph over the angel of death, who tried to frustrate his highest ambition? Or shall the Jew be like Moses, hitting the rock with his cane and make the rock yield water? Shall the Jew bow before fate as Jacob bowed before Esau 7 times? Or shall the Jew struggle with fate and forge his own destiny the way the same Jacob struggled with the divine antagonist through the night and emerged victorious? This is the problem. Shall Jewishness be a factor to be accepted, or shall Jewishness be a free actus, an act on the part of man? Shall Jewishness be considered, as Heidegger says, the state of being thrown in, of being eingeworfen, as Heidegger says? I was thrown in into the Jewish fold without the Creator consulting me before birth. I was thrown in into minority community, insecure and self-conscious, haunted by fears and uncertain presentiments. Shall we reconcile with this state of affairs? Then Jewishness becomes a nightmare. Let's not fool ourselves. A nightmare, a curse, a monstrosity. The Jew is tossed by the Satan nowhere along empty and dark spaces into tohu wabohu. Like the autumn wind drives the withered leaf along uncharted roots into the haze of nothingness. Jewishness as a fate, then the Jewish God, you know what his name is? It's very interesting. If Jewishness is a fate, de facto Jews, Jewishness as a factisti, as also a God, perhaps a destructive God. You know what his name is? I'll show you in the Bible. Will you be so kind and open the Bible, Exodus chapter 5. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. And afterward, Moses and Aaron, Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. Verse 1, 2, 3. And afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness. And Elokei Yisrael. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go. And they said, they repeated the request, but they did something very peculiar. They changed the name of the God. First they call him the Lord, Havayah, Jehovah, the God of Israel, the eternal, the everlasting one, the God of Israel. Then they said, and they said, Elokeinu Ivrim, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. What's the difference between Elokei Israel, the God of Israel, and the God of the Hebrews? You know what Hebrews means? Ivri means lonely. Eiver Anor, why was Abraham called, was called Ivri? Abraham the Hebrew, because he was from the other side of the river. He was from Mesopotamia. He came from Mesopotamia into Israel. He was always a stranger. So actually means a Jew, if the Jew is, accepts fate, then he accepts God. But it's a strange God. I wouldn't like to be in his company. This is the God of the Hebrews, Elokeinu Ivrim, the God of loneliness, the God of strangeness, the God of not belonging, or of belonging nowhere. If the Jew views himself in terms of his acceptance into general society, in categories of the Tao, in the mirror, according in terms of his reflection, the mirror of the press, politics, and artificial appraisal, then he feels isolated, expelled, and abandoned. Such a state of mind leads to all kinds of mental anomalies, including self-hatred. You must hate God, because God isolated you. He's the God of loneliness, of suffering and cruelty. And if one hates God, he must ipso facto hate himself. Of course, what I want to interject now is perhaps homiletical. I know Dr. Eisenberg is very particular about it, but still it fits beautifully into that. When I see modern Jew who does not try to forge his Jewish destiny, but accepts it, not accepts it, it was foisted upon him by his parents. The parents didn't do it, I mean, voluntarily either. I mean, he was thrown in an anger often. And how he's tossed by the wind of circumstances, of accidents, by the wind of capricious fate, blind, cruel, capricious fate. And he tries to hide himself. I always remind myself of the story of Jonah the prophet. It's a strange prophet. When Jonah was fleeing God, the trouble is that the God of loneliness is hard to flee. He catches up with you. And the question, the book of Jonah, it is among the 12 books. Jonah chapter 1, and verse 5. But Jonah was gone down into the back of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep. Wanted to forget about the fact that he's traveling on a ship, and the people somehow are trying to examine his background. So the shipmaster came to him and said unto him, What meanest thou, a sleeper? Arise, call upon thy God, if so be that God will think upon us, that we perish not. And then you'll take verse 8. And then they said unto him, Tell us, we pray thee, for whose cause this evil is upon us? What is thine occupation? And whence comest thou? What is thy country? And of what people art thou? Sometimes we are pressed by the shipmaster, whoever he is, to acknowledge something about ourselves. It's a very embarrassing question, I tell you. I lived in Germany, gentlemen, many, many years. I knew assimilated Jews of Germany very well. And this question used to come up time and again. Whence, what is thy occupation? Whence comest thou? Why should they ask the Jews? The Jews lived in Germany longer than the Germans themselves, perhaps. At least as long as a civilized community. In the 9th or 10th century, I mean, there were Jews in Germany, certainly. Shalaman, even Shalaman already had dealt with Jewish communities. Until the question came up. And what people are thou? When this question is asked, there is only one answer to be given. And this answer can be given only by the person who accepts Judaism not as a fate, but as a destiny. And this answer gave Jonah the prophet. And he said, he understood that it's impossible to escape from God. And he said unto them, I am a Hebrew. I am a lonely person. And I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, which hath made the sea and the dry land. The moment he gave this answer, there was a change in his philosophy. Complete change in his philosophy. However, there is no need for it. There is no need for it. However, Jewishness should be raised and can from the plain nonsensical facticity to that of an intelligent destiny. When fate is filled with sense, then you just take and infuse a little sense into fate. And meaning, teleological motifs, and directedness, then the Jew exchanges loneliness, I wouldn't say for companionship, but at least for aloneness, for prophetic solitude. And his God is already not Elokei Ivrim, but Havaye Elokei Yisrael, the God of Israel. The everlasting one, the God of Israel, which denotes what does Israel mean. And I told you, why was Jacob called Israel? When was he called Israel? When he triumphed over the antagonist. Israel means the triumphant personality. Man triumphs over circumstances and fate, which denotes the charismatic community of victory, of spiritual power, of triumph over men and divine antagonists. Genesis 33, 28, I read it this. However, in order to perform this metamorphosis of fate into destiny, I would use the Greek expression metabasis is aliogenos. It means a jump into a different class. I mean, it's not an easy jump. It's quite possible. A Jew must become aware of his inner worth. This is number one. As a Jew, not always a person. As inner worth, of his numinous character, of his uniqueness as individual, of his singular position with regard to God and to man, in a manner reminiscent of the spiritual personality in general. He has got to discover his greatness within his own existential experience, within himself. When I say uniqueness of a Jew, well, I want you not to misunderstand me. I mean it in the same sense which I employed with regard to Abraham. Abraham was a Hittite, externally. I mean it not in terms of the external appearance, under no circumstances. I don't mean it in terms of dress, speech, mannerism, education, and also political, economic, and social commitment. You should be committed, involved. This was a Jewish tradition, involved in every institution of learning, in every institution of charity, in every institution of endeavor, of collective endeavor, in the country in which we live. This was the tradition of Abraham. This was the tradition inherited from Moses. Moses was an Egyptian prince. We don't preach, perhaps there are some, I wouldn't say, there is a lunatic fringe within Orthodoxy. I mean, I'm not trying to hide the fact which preaches separation, complete withdrawal, even external withdrawal. I am very far from this philosophy. For a simple reason, I mean, I don't have to go into detail, for a simple reason, you cannot practice it. I mean, it's the best reason. It's impossible. The Jew is integrated now in the general society, more or less. In spite of his feeling of loneliness and isolation, he is still integrated. You cannot change that. I mean, you cannot go back into ghetto. It's out. Any Orthodox movement which preaches return to the ghetto is simply preaches suicide. National suicide. I don't mean that. I don't mean a ghetto. I've never meant it. Dress, speech, education, political, social, economic, even patriotic commitment. The Jew is a citizen of the country. With regard to all the things belonging into the sphere and activities of charismatic man, of men in society, who externalizes a part of himself, he makes a contribution to the general welfare, the Jew is equal to anybody else. The uniqueness of the Jew is related to the numinous aspect of him, to his inner world, in which he finds himself, strange and incomprehensible, to his questing for and addressing himself to God, to his emotional life, his depth of personality, his yearnings and strivings, his love for others, his worldview, his private life, his sentimental relationships with his family, with his wife, with his children. There the Jew is unique and should discover in himself the experience of aloneness. It's a great experience, gentlemen. I'll show you later how it expresses itself. I'm speaking in vague terms now. Well, but probably the next lecture I'll take on this problem.
Yes.
If you will ask me how can I characterize Jewish uniqueness, I'm speaking Jewish uniqueness. You'll ask me what is Jewish uniqueness? No. If you'll ask the Satmar Rebbe, he'll tell you what Jewish uniqueness is. Long kaftan, this and that, all right. The terms he'll use will not be vague or equivocal in any sense, but my terms will be equivocal, yes. But I don't want to employ this, so to say. How can Jewish uniqueness be expressed? Of course, I want you to say that more I'll have to speak as an Orthodox rabbi, not preaching my experience. Later. Okay. You can take it, you can reject it. But it's a philosophy now, what I have. And I'm not speaking. Jewish uniqueness, in my opinion, not you know, commitment, of course. A contract implies commitment. Bilateral taking on of obligation. This means a covenantal community. A community which is bound by certain commitments made at the dawn of its history and still binding upon generations to come. In a word, the Jewish people form a community of the committed. If you'll ask me what are the Jewish people? A community. But not a free man completely, and I'm using not free in the sense, metaphysical sense, more in a derogatory sense, not a man, just are free to do anything they want, of people who are committed. Not slaves, but people committed to something. We are a community of dedicated, of the dedicated ones, of the committed ones. A historical and metaphysical load has been placed upon our shoulders. And it's up to the Jew, it's up to him, either to consider this strange burden as something unwanted and undesired, while trying to cast it off. And of course, if he tries to cast off like Jonah, he will not being able to cast off, to throw off this burden, Jewishness turns into a fate, into a curse. Or he can accept this commitment freely, the load freely accept, and dedicate himself to carry on and pass on. In this case, Jewishness becomes elevated to destiny. Yes. What did our commitment express itself, our historical commitment? I believe at two levels, and I believe basically I've accepted two obligations. About it, I'll speak next time.
What did you translate on school?
How come to it? It's the official translation is peculiar treasure, isn't it?
Sorry.
Yes, sure. How come to it?
Thank you.
Comes to the English text as a guide, as not works, I'm lost. I mean, I simply can't find anything. I mean, I have trouble finding a chapter. You're used to certain text, you cannot get used to another one. Now, let us resume the thread. I mean, we left off last time. We spoke about probably the question of Jewish loneliness and fate and destiny in Judaism. And we said that Judaism can either be conceived and also experienced as a fate, so to say, as a fact imposed upon man, or can also be forged as a destiny, freely accepted and made part of my existential awareness. And we, of course, we said that basically the uniqueness of the Jew expresses itself in his being a member of a covenantal community. Then we ask what the covenant stands for, and we answer that covenant means commitment. And we are a community of the committed ones. We are committed to some goal, to some ultimate end. We are not free in certain respects. We have assumed obligations. What kind of obligations we assume? This is exactly the question which I have to take up today. Yes. Before I'll speak about the obligation of the covenant, and I said basically there were two covenants actually reached, and these two covenants will express the uniqueness of the Jew and his peculiar station in society. As I spoke last time, we are old timers, residents, as Abraham said, and also strangers, sojourners. We are both at home and homeless. We are politically, economically, culturally at home in the United States, but transcendentally, metaphysically, the Jew is a homeless person. He is committed to the beyond. But before I'm going to analyze the two basic covenants, which in my opinion express the essence and the gist of Judaism, I would like to add just a parenthetic remark. Basically, what we have accepted when we reached a covenant with God in our emergence as a people, or as a community, as a charismatic community, is a load, because any commitment is a load on the person. It's a burden. To be committed means to carry a burden, to carry a load. And it's very interesting, in Hebrew, it is something which is almost paradoxical, that the word prophecy, nevuah, in Hebrew, and the word masa, a burden, load, are synonyms. Many times the scriptures, instead of saying Malachi prophesied, so masa dvar adeshem biyad Malachi, the burden of God's word on Malachi. Masa, mem, sin, aleph. Masa dvar adeshem biyad Malachi. In the 12 prophets, the last of the 12 prophets, Masa Dvar HaDeshem B'Yad Malachi. What does it mean, a burden? Apparently the prophet's task, Judaism is a prophetic religion, was not considered a very easy one, a simple one. It was a load. And a load, if I may say, a transcendental load. There is sometimes one carries a load which is a natural load. This load does not weigh heavily upon the shoulders. But many times the load is a paradoxical one, which cannot be spelled out and interpreted in rational terms. And such a load, which I can experience, but I cannot understand many times, which is beyond my comprehension. But still, I cannot cast it off. Somehow, I mean, this load, if I try to cast it off, it begins to trail me like an everlasting shadow. So this load is the load of the prophets. So it means our commitment is a prophetic commitment. And if we say we are a community of committed, it means we are a community of prophets. And Moses said, Moses, or in the Bible, for instance,
good. Moses said, will you be so kind and take the Bible? I'll just 1 second. Yes. Yes, this is Numbers, just a moment. Numbers, I don't see the chapters here. Numbers 11, verse 29.
Numbers, the fourth book in the Pentateuch. 11, verse 29. I would refer you to verse first, to verse, just a moment, to verse 27. And there ran a young man and told Moses, was Joshua, his disciple, and said, Eldad and Medad, names, are prophesying in the camp. He thought that the fact that Eldad and Medad became prophets would annoy Moses because they would emerge as his competitors. And they would compete for leadership. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the minister, the errand boy of Moses, from his youth up, answered and said, it is Numbers 11, 28, my Lord Moses, shut them in. So for disobedience, for insubordination. And Moses said unto him, art thou jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit upon them? Isn't it my wish that all the people of the Lord were prophets and the Lord should put his spirit on them? That means this is my vision, this is my dream. And if two people, commoners, began to prophesy, accepted the Lord, I mean, this is a happy day. I mean, it's in my calendar. You should not be envious. You should not display jealousy for my sake. This exactly. And the Talmudic expression is, in Yisrael, imenam nevim, b'nei nevim imam. If they are not prophets themselves, at least they are sons of prophets. It means prophecy is their heritage. What does prophecy mean in this case, with regard to us, the Jewish community as a whole? Nothing transcendental, nothing supernatural, nothing metaphysical, but the acceptance of a load. Because prophecy basically is a load in people. Massa. Yes? If you want the Bible, Malachi, Massa Dvar HaDeshem al Yisrael v'yad Malachi. It is the 12 prophets. It's following Ezekiel, but the last of the 12 prophets, the small prophets. The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. This is official English translation, it's the correct translation. I never rely too much on the English translation because it's due to the Vulgata and the Septuaginta, the Greek and the Latin translation, but in this case they're right. The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. It's a burden. Prophecy in the Bible is called Massa, burden, which even though weighs heavily upon the shoulders of the prophet, lends dignity and greatness to man. I wouldn't say it gives him comfort, or it gives him ease, or even peace of mind, but at least dignity and greatness to man. Interesting is the description of Jeremiah. Jeremiah described the burden of the prophet and the solitude I spoke last time. The solitude of the prophet. His loneliness, or as I said last time, his aloneness. In terse, but poignant words. And he also let us in on the secret of the response such an experience evokes Let us quote Jeremiah indirectly by introducing a passage from Maimonides, the guide. Do you have the guide? Is it the same edition? It's part 2, section 2, page 181, if you have the guide. Page 181, part 2, section 2, I believe. It is chapter 37, at the end of the chapter. Chapter 37, are the pages the same? I mean, it's a different edition. But chapter 37, at the end. Yes, but the characteristic of the intellect is this. It means the intellect of the prophet. No, before. Will you be so kind that you'll just... But the characteristic, it is the end of chapter 37, section 2. Maimonides gives a description of the intellect of the prophet. It's a typological description, basically. But the characteristic of the intellect is this. What the intellect of one receives, it means of the prophet, is transmitted to another, and so on, till a person is reached that can only himself be perfected by such... Just a moment. It is further the nature of this element in man. This exactly. The following sentence. That he who possesses an additional degree of that influence, it means the prophet. It's very poor translation. I mean, whoever knows the Arabic in the Hebrew text, it's a very influence, a very poor translation. Even the Hebrew Ashpah is something else. Anyway, influence is compelled to address his fellow man. There is a compulsion. Under all circumstances, whether he is listened or to or not, even if he injures himself thereby. This is the nature of the prophetic breath. In men there is almost, it is compelling. Actually, it would be ridiculous to apply a psychiatric term, but this means a certain anomaly. It's compulsive on the part of the prophet. He has to do it. Although his best interests tell him, don't do that. Don't get involved. Because you are a rebel against society. You try to overthrow social order. You voice protest against accepted sacred institutions. Thus, we find prophets that did not leave off speaking to the people until they were slain. It is this divine influence that moves them, that does not allow them to rest in any way. It's one of the most beautiful chapters in the Guide. Maimonides is always grand, and he stops philosophizing and speaks in a simple language. When he is not over-sophisticated, my mind is, allow them to rest in any way, though they might bring upon themselves great evils by their action. When Jeremiah was despised, like other teachers and scholars of his age, he could not, though he desired it, he wanted, withhold his prophecy, or cease from reminding the people of the truth which they rejected. And Jeremiah said, he quoted Jeremiah, for the word of the Lord was unto me a reproach and a mocking all day. And I said, I will not mention it, nor will I again speak in his name. He wanted to desert his mission, but it was in mine heart a burning fire, enclosed in my bones, and I was wearied to keep it, and did not prevail. This is also the meaning of the word of another prophet. The Lord God hath spoken. Who shall not prophesy? I mean, we have the ability to suppress the message. And this is not just, ladies and gentlemen, a characteristic of the prophet of all. It is basically the characteristic of the Jewish community. Because as I said, we have accepted the burden. The burden is not, we cannot just either cast it off and not to prophesy, we are compelled to prophesy. this is exactly the covenant interpreted more or less in personalistic terms, I would say. Now, let me now examine the covenant itself. This is very important. This is just as a parenthetic remark. If we examine the history of the covenant as portrayed in Exodus, we will find out that God established with his people two covenants. One in Egypt before the Exodus, and the other one at Sinai at the time of Revelation. Now let's open Exodus 6, verses 5, 6, 7. Exodus 6, verses 5, 6, 7. Exodus 6, verses 5, 6, 7. Yes, Exodus 6, verses 5, 6, 7. And more, perhaps we'll go back to verse 2. I am the Lord, and I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the four letter name, Tetragrammaton, I made me not known to them, and I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their sojournings, wherein they sojourn. And moreover, I have heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore, say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord. It means the establishment of the covenant is always, I am the Lord. And I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgment. And again, and I will take you to me. This is the most important sentence in the covenant. And I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God. And ye shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. This is the covenant. Only the covenant, so to say, the finale of a covenant is, I am your God, you are my people. It's an agreement, contract, basically. This is the first covenant that I spoke of at the Exodus. Now if you'll take the book of Exodus, the same book, chapter 19, instead of chapter 6, chapter 19, verses 4 and 5. The famous address to Moses before the revelation. It's very famous. 4. 19, verse 4. Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if ye will hearken unto me, unto my voice, indeed, and keep my covenant, there ye shall be mine own treasure from among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I emphasis placed upon the last two words, holy nation. Now, it's very interesting. The covenant of Egypt, but I must introduce here a Hebrew term, because in English, of course, you have the two terms, but they don't correspond. The covenant of Egypt, if you go back to Exodus chapter 6, verse 7. And I will take you to me for a people. In Hebrew it is, Velokachti eschem li le'om, a people, I am, I mean, concluding man, a people. So it's God speaks in terms of a people, as in Hebrew means I'll have to operate with this term. Iron, mem stuma means the concluding man. Iron, a people. Here he says the word goy kadosh, goy. I mean, in Yiddish, in vernacular, goy has assumed a funny, I don't know how it developed, but a funny meaning. I mean, goy means an angel, but goy basically means a nation. This is a nation. Apparently it was so. I mean, how it developed, and I can imagine how it developed. The Talmud dealt with with pagans. So the pagan was Akum. Of course, then when the Christian society came up, so they eliminated the word pagan, because Christians are not pagans. So they had to describe a non-Jew. How can you say a non-Jew? It means a man who belongs to another nation, of another nationality. So apparently at the beginning it was Goy Acher, a different nationality. So finally the printer decided, why do they have the name, why do they need the qualification Acher? So they left the word Goy. Goy means a nation. This is how it has developed over the ages. I mean, basically, but basically Goy means, in Hebrew means, Goy Kadosh means a holy nation. If I should say in English, but it is bad, it is in sense of political science and sociologically, it would not correspond semantically. In the covenant, with regard to the covenant of Egypt, God speaks in terms of peoplehood. With regard to the covenant at Mount Sinai, he speaks in terms of nationhood, Goy Kadosh. You'll be my people. In Sinai, he says, you'll be a sacred nation. And I'm not speaking about the sacredness, about the adjectival qualification of sacredness. I'm not concerned for the time being with that. We'll come later what sacredness means in Judaism. But here is Goy, and there is Am. What's the difference between peoplehood and nationhood? But you see, when you look up a dictionary on political science, you'll get it completely a different view. Because, for instance, in English you can say the American nation consists of many peoples. So people actually means something, I mean, we have a racial origin, common origin. A nation basically means a political society in the colloquial now, in the vernacular. I don't mean the vernacular, in the scientific vernacular. But this is not what I'm going. Basically, nation, from the Latin natus, born. I mean, basically, it has nothing to do with the political society. But I'll orientate myself, not according to the established, let's say, definitions of the political, I mean, in any, which you'll find in any political dictionary, a dictionary of political science, but what in Hebrew means am a people and goy a nation. That's what I want to describe. Am in Hebrew basically means im, together. Because in Hebrew if you say, I was with him, so say, ani bati imado, or im chaveri, im yiridi. I came with him. So it means, im means together. So out of im, the noun, the term am, was formed, you see, was emerged, and am, not, I mean, denotes togetherness. Togetherness. Denotes togetherness. Unity. Apparently, let us not speak about the covenant at Sinai. Let us take up the covenant in Egypt. The covenant in Egypt apparently committed us. It's again a commitment, again a load, and again, if I may use a term by Plato, Maimonides, and Kierkegaard, it was a mad commitment, a crazy commitment, paradoxical, absurd commitment, but it was that. Of course, we are too practical, perhaps, if we had been consulted. We wouldn't have accepted it. But apparently our parents forefathers, it was not as practically minded and as pragmatically orientated as we are. So we accepted, but it's a crazy commitment. Paradoxical means a togetherness commitment. That's all, nothing else. A togetherness commitment. The covenant in Egypt committed us to a community existence. Because basically means community. some unity. And I would say, I would add one phrase, there are so many communities. There are political communities and scientific communities and educational communities and all kinds of communities. Because there is a community, I mean, any common denominator, I mean, for it, it's a community. I would say it was an existential community. Our very existence as individuals and as members of a society is a together existence, not a single existence. The covenant addresses itself, the covenant in Egypt, prima facie, not only prima facie, but actually primarily, I would say, primarily addresses itself to the numinous eye, about whom I spoke in the last lecture. To the eye, I would say not the numinous eye, but the numinous Jew. To man, to the Jew in seclusion. To the eye in seclusion or the Jew in seclusion. To man or to the Jew for himself. To solitary Abraham. If Adam is the symbol of man in general, is Abraham the symbol of the Jew in general? To solitary Abraham. And commends him, the man who is sheltered by his ego existence, somehow is afraid to tear down the barrier separating him from the Tao, addresses itself, or God through the covenant addressed himself to the numinous Jew and commanded him to become accustomed to live with the other self. It's a great art. Covenant, contract. A covenant, the mere word covenant, the mere word ka, the Latin ka, what does it mean? Already together. Like im in Hebrew, like him in Hebrew means together, ka. Whatever there's in Latin ka is together, to get convened together, to be together, to live together. The covenant contract means something which grows out of a relationship between two beings. Out of a relationship between two beings. I and thou. The numinous I, whenever he enters a contractual arrangement with God, first of all, the covenant is established between man and God. But the moment a man reaches an agreement with God, he ipso facto commits himself also to the finite Tao. Because God never enters in agreement with the individual unless this is Judaic thinking. Unless the individual is ready to commit himself not only to God, but we call it in our vernacular, the infinite Tao, not only this commitment is not that important to God as the commitment to the finite Tao. God says, yeah, we'll enter an agreement, but not only between two people. If we are going to reach an agreement for our community, I want three members. The community, three members should comprise the community. Who are the three members? Who are they? I, God, thou, and he. Basically, the covenant is composed of three people, of the three persona of the grammar. Basically, it is the three persona of the grammar. It is I, thou, and he. Of course, man can say, I'm an aristocrat, I don't want to join him. It is not below my dignity to reach an agreement with God. I can't have, so say, social intercourse with God, he's a prominent citizen. But I'm a little bit reluctant to join that thou. Thou doesn't come up to me socially, economically, educationally. So there is no agreement. It is I, capital I, thou, and he. So thou and he is small. This is im, together, but not together with God. Together with God and with another finite being whom you don't like.
Hmm.
Of course. The individual, numinous self, who was in seclusion, try if he accepts the agreement, then it tries to, if he accepts the agreement, this is the conditio sine qua non, otherwise no agreement is reached. If he accepts the terms of the agreement, so he tries, or has to try at least, to liberate himself from solitude. It's an act. To liberate himself from solitude and join hands with the other self. The other self is also a bit stubborn and obstinate, and he is also hiding in the recesses of his own personality. He doesn't want to come out of this warm shelter. But he's forced by the covenant. Come out! Emerge! Out of your head. Covenant basically means fellowship. Of God, as I said, I, thou, and he. The first emergence, basically what happens, charismatic man. I spoke about numinous man and charismatic man. Who forces numinous man to emerge into the open, to pass on his message to society, and to become a member of society, of the community? Who forces him? Religiously, of course, sociologically, you have many forces, I mean, anthropologically. But I'm speaking now from the standpoint of religion. Who forces the numinous Jew to become a member of a community, regardless whether it is in accordance with his interests, or it is sometimes, I mean, as my man says, sometimes he may inflict injury upon himself by committing himself to others. Who forces him? The covenant. Man, secluded man, looks for companionship. Although it's sometimes very hard to get out, I mean, of his shelter, because of the covenant. Out, charismatic man, out of the recesses of his numinous existence. And this occurs with the establishment of a covenantal society. The community is a strange one, it's a strange community. It is an all-inclusive fellowship. The difference between the Judaic community and the secular community, the sociological community, is only one. One difference. The sociological community is I, thou, and he. Correct? That's all. I mean, all three persona of the grammar form a community, nothing else. If you have many, say it in plural. It's we, you, and they. That's all, nothing else. The Jewish community, the biblical community, and this community which was accepted in Jewish history, I mean, theologically, is a community also. I, thou, he, small, and he, capital. That's all. There is a fourth member to the community. And the fourth member of the community is God himself. It's a community of finitude and infinity. It's an all-inclusive community. The sociological community is restricted, confined to the dimensions of finitude, while the Judaic community is an all-inclusive community. It's finitude plus infinity. Of course, mathematically, it's a paradox. Because if you take finitude plus infinity, mathematically, it equals infinity. Correct. So it means finitude disappears. But in our viewpoint, there is a place for finitude, for finite man, to exist in the presence of God. God does not consume man, does not smother him. Man and God can be two equal fellows in one society. There is a funny approach in Judaism. Christianity had never understood it in its life. Never. There is equality between God and man on one hand, and of course on the other hand, it is an endless gap. But on one hand, God is my friend. Now you have it. Adeshem Rei Le Echsa is quite possible. So we all translate, God is my shepherd, I shall not want. But it's quite possible that the real interpretation, Nachmanides wants to say so, is God is my friend, my colleague, I shall not want. But basically in Hebrew is Roy a shepherd, and Rey a colleague might stem from the same origin. Yes, the covenant, now let's come back. This is the covenant in Egypt. This covenant, this sort of a covenant was established in Israel. The covenant of Am, let us stick to the Hebrew term, because It expresses, I mean, the very essence of the covenant. The covenant of arm, of togetherness, of a community existence, of a fellowship of I, thou, he and he, capital, finds expression, I would say, at many levels. And I won't say it in practical terms. Up to here it was
a bit that I operated with some abstract terms, but Judaism is always likes any metaphysical idea. To see any metaphysical idea translated into practical terms. If it cannot be expressed in practical terms and made and converted into a norm to guide man, metaphysics, in the opinion of the Judaic, I mean of Judaism, has no significance. It means like that, together. It's a covenant of together, yes? Togetherness. And let me make it very simple. First, togetherness in the present. Togetherness in the present. It means community, and please note each word because I'm going to explain it. Community of interest. Feelings and responsibilities. Community of interests, feelings, and responsibilities. And I would say more than interests, feelings, and responsibilities, I would say a community of experiences. This would cover everything. And a community of experiences, both passional experiences, it means experiences of suffering, passio, passional experiences, and also eudaimonic experiences, experiences of happiness. At both levels. So number one, but in the present, right here and now. Second, this is the covenant. This is what the covenant requires of us. This is the law. Second, together at the level of the historical drama. Unity of the historical drama. Or unity of the historical occurrence. Or together in all three dimensions of time. Together in the past, or rather together with the past. I would say rather, together with the past, which is gone, together with the future, which hasn't been born yet. It is together of events which have almost faded out our memory, together with events which have not yet taken place. It means together in memory and together in hope. Together in retrospect and together in vision and hope and dream. This is the second element of the covenant. Now let us analyze, come back. Let us analyze the covenant as far as it pertains to the present. To the present. The covenant, I mean, as I said, a community of interests, responsibilities, and experiences, really. Passional and eudaimonic. Means pleasant experiences and unpleasant experiences. What does it mean? I mean, in practical terms, a very simple practical terms. It's no use, I mean, beating around the bush in such matters. I mean, you have to spell it out the way Judaism tried to spell it out. You should never make it a life. Philosophy. This is the trouble with now modern existentialism. If applied to Judaic problems, it's a nice philosophy, in Italian. But you know, I ask one of the leaders, all right. But I ask him in Yiddish, well, what is the tachlis? All right, everything said and done. So what is the conclusion? What shall we do? After all, the Jew always asked, what shall I do? The Greek asked, what is it? But the Jew, in order to understand what he should do, must understand what the world stands for, of course. What is the problem with the prophet What does God demand from you? Well, what did he want? Never mind. Metaphysics. Together in the present, this covenantal commitment can be spelled out again, gentlemen, is together in the present at three practical, I would say in three practical different areas of endeavor. First of all, unity of interests. I would say solidarity. All Jews, that's what Judaism tries to tell us many times, all Jews share the same historical destiny. No Jew, however prominent or anonymous, regardless, perhaps very prominent and anonymous, nobody, may submerge in the crowd and disappear, and by so doing, escape the destiny of our people. No one is exempted from the terms of the common historical affairs. There are no exemptions in the Jewish community. Differences as to color, because basically we are a people, funny people. It's hard to say we are one race here. I mean, if judged by criteria of anthropological criteria, I don't care about it anymore. Because to us, Judaism, the convert, the proselyte, is just the same aristocrat as the high priest. I mean, so these racial elements absolutely play no role in Judaism. Judaism, if there is some charismatic endowment in Judaism, it's not a biological endowment, our blood, our body is the same. It is the load. It depends how much of a load we carry. And of course, if one carries a bigger load, this might be a chosen person, of course. And if one tries to lighten his load, of course, he's not as chosen as other one. And it's up to us, I mean, to be chosen or to be like any other people or to be below the level of any other people. I always say, the Jew basically has two alternatives. He hasn't got three. It's either he's above other people or he's below. Like others is a heart, I don't know. It's hard to be like others. I don't know. Here we are. You see, the Midrash says, Umazu, this nation, when it begins to ascend, it may reach the stars. And when it begins to roll down the hill, it may reach unfathomable depths. I mean, sink to very low. Anyway, let's differences in the color of the skin, cultural diversity, economic discrepancies, language, dress, mores, and differences in the general social milieu must not dispel the feeling of solidarity which binds all Jews together. Whether they live in the culturally advanced Western societies, or in the Far East, or in Israel, or in North Africa, whether they live on Park Avenue, or in the Mela, in Algiers, or in Algeria, they all are exposed to similar vicissitudes.